You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up in the next 60 minutes with news that rebel forces have taken a strategic airbase near Aleppo, we'll discuss the latest developments in Syria. And as New Yorkers head out for their lunch, we'll check in on the morning's news with our associate editor, Barrett Austin. Barrett, what do you have for us?
We'll be taking a look at what's on President Obama's agenda ahead of tonight's State of the Union address, and we'll also talk about a new report that suggests the airline industry is safer than ever.
Excellent. Hear more from you later. We'll also be joined in the studio by author of a groundbreaking parenting Bible with a difference, Andrew Solomon. And with Lent fast approaching, we'll have a cake-off of sorts. Our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, will be rustling up pancakes in the kitchen with a challenger from Sweden who makes Nordic Lent buns, Semlor. Steve, are you nervous about the face-off?
Not at all. We're very well prepared here in the kitchen at Midori House. I've got my eggs, I've got my sugar, I've got my flour. What more could I possibly need?
Yum, let's hope you're turning them into pancakes. All that plus, we'll be asking if the fashion show circuit is becoming too much like a circus, and we'll be playing some sweet music too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House, live on Monocle 24. But before all that, let's catch up on the latest world headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
North Korea has told the United Nations Disarmament Forum it'll never bow to UN resolutions on its nuclear program, despite worldwide condemnation of today's nuclear test. China, North Korea's only main ally, has condemned the test itself, which had a magnitude of 4.9 and occurred this morning at 2:58 GMT. The European Union has also condemned the test, saying it poses a threat to both regional and international peace. The EU Commission spokesperson in Brussels is Maja Kocianic.
It's another step towards developing the nuclear weapons program, which is against the obligations that North Korea has in international obligations, specifically UN Security Council resolutions. We also believe it represents a threat to the peace and security of not only Korean Peninsula, but also more broadly, regionally and internationally.
In other UN matters, the UN nuclear watchdog says it will work hard during talks in Tehran this week to try to bridge differences with Iran over a stalled investigation into its disputed nuclear activities. The International Atomic Energy Agency Deputy Director General is Herman Nackertz.
Our goal is to finalize the structured approach document. Now, this document would facilitate the resolution of the outstanding issues related to Iran's to the possible military dimensions of Iran's nuclear program. Differences remain, and also this time we will try to work hard. We will work hard to try to resolve these differences. We'll have good negotiations.
European Union Commissioner Olli Rehn said today that the European Commission was not working on a debt restructuring plan for Cyprus. Speaking at the end of an EU finance ministers' meeting in Brussels, Rehn added that any bailout for Cyprus must ensure the island's stability.
We are working in order to find a solution that ensures both debt sustainability and financial stability in Cyprus. And I want to underline that we are indeed working towards such solutions that do ensure financial stability in Cyprus and in the rest of the Eurozone.
Pope Benedict XVI is the first pope to resign in 700 years, saying he no longer has the mental and physical strength to carry on. Reuters Vatican correspondent Philip Putella said the pope will resign later this month.
It's like a death pre-announced. In other words, he is going to die on February 28th. That's when all the machinery to elect a new pope would begin kicking in. It's as if he dies that day. He disappears, more or less, and the entire machinery begins cranking up to elect a new pope. So it's going to be a very, very strange situation for the next couple of weeks, and it's going to be perhaps even stranger after February 28th.
Meanwhile, protesters from the Femen pressure group have staged a topless protest today inside Paris's historic Notre Dame Cathedral to celebrate the Pope's resignation and the passage of a gay marriage bill. The group leader is Irina Shevchenko.
Came here to celebrate finally that all male homophobes are gave up. We're celebrating that Pope is quitting, we're celebrating today's election of voting of the law. We won. Gay marriage will be here. Homophobe gave up. Shame on the church, shame on religion.
And finally, a story involving a comedian, a millionaire and an orangutan. It may well sound like the beginning of a joke, but Donald Trump isn't laughing. The famously outspoken real estate magnate has sued famously outspoken television host Bill Maher, demanding the $5 million Maher has offered to give to charity if Trump could prove his father is not an orangutan. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. It's 18:06 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London. London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Via Monaco, Varasiti Cheche.
From London,
London, Karachi.
London, London.
This is Monaco 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Hugo MacDonald. According to the latest reports from the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, the rebel forces have made significant advances in the north of the country. They've taken the strategic military airbase near the city of Aleppo after days of clashes. It's the latest in a string of reported triumphs for the rebels. It was reported on Sunday that they managed to take over the city of Tabwa and the Altoura Dam nearby too. To give us his view on the latest advances of the rebels, I'm joined now on the line by Fawaz Jerjez, Professor of Middle Eastern Politics and International Relations at the London School of Economics. Thank you very much for joining us, Fawaz. I wonder if you could just start by shedding light on what the latest developments exactly are.
Well, I mean, the rebels have made some very significant tactical advances in the last few weeks, in particular in the north. Today they captured one of the major military bases. The first time they captured basically jet fighters that can be used, jet fighters that are intact. And really what happened is that basically the Syrian government forces collapsed in just a few hours. Yesterday they captured one of the most important strategic dams called Al-Thawra, as you mentioned. They have reached security in the heart of the capital, Damascus. So the rebels have made tactical advances. The question is, so far, basically there is a military stalemate. Neither side can deliver a decisive blow, even though the rebels seem to have the momentum, in particular recently.
And Fawaz, how big a blow is this for the Syrian government? Do you think this could be a turning point in this stalemate that you mentioned there?
You know, I can't tell you how many times we keep saying turning points. Mm. There have been so many turning points, so many watersheds. The reality is this is a fight to the bitter end. The reality is the Assad regime will fight for every block, every street, in particular, not just in Aleppo. Aleppo is deeply divided now between the armed opposition and the Assad regime. The biggest battle to come is Damascus. This is really where the mother of all battles will take place. Almost 2 years on, there is a strategic stalemate, military stalemate. My take on it is that in the long term, the opposition tactical gains will likely accumulate into a strategic breakthrough. But for the moment, the war and the battles continue.
It does seem, though, that the rebels are gaining momentum, and particularly with these advances and strategic takeovers that they've done in the past few weeks, it feels as if sort of the north of the country is really under their control, largely. Where would they go from now, do you think?
Well, I mean, they're going to go all the way to Damascus. This is really where, I mean, the reality is, my take on it is that, they, as you said, they have gained most of the north, from the Turkish borders up to Aleppo. And the Aleppo battle, even though there's a stalemate, my take on it, if we're talking about the rebels being able to take over the city in the next few weeks and next few months, in particular if they maintain the momentum. And then the battle is in Damascus. If Aleppo has taken more than a year, you can imagine how long it will take in Damascus. In the meantime, I mean, Aleppo has almost been destroyed. Imagine Damascus, one of the oldest inhabited cities in the world, if the fight for Damascus turns out to be as nasty, as brutal, as devastating as the Aleppo battle.
Indeed, it's unimaginable horrors that will unfold, I'm sure. And but you mentioned earlier that the fighter jets in the airbase that the rebels have taken are fully operational. Do you think we'll see the rebels start to use these sort of soon?
Well, we have to wait and see, because remember, I mean, the regime itself has hundreds. You're talking about between 300 and 400 jet fighters. So if the rebels have two or three jet fighters, they have to be very careful. They have to have the pilots. They have to be able to manage to have ammunition. So even though it's a major gain, it's very difficult to translate this particular gain into a weapon that can be used effectively against the Assad regime.
Well, Fawaz Jerjez, thank you very much for joining us. We will certainly be talking to you again to get the latest on developments as they unfold in the coming days. It's Fawaz Jerjez, Professor of Middle Eastern Politics and International Relations at the London School of Economics. Welcome back to Midori House, where the time in London is 18:12. And today, on the 12th of February, it is Pancake Day, or Shrove Tuesday, as some may know it. We have our very own pancake battle unfolding in the kitchen. And we're going to go over to the kitchen in Midori House, where our news editor, Tom Edwards, is wielding a microphone in front of foreign editor Steve Bloomfield, who's getting busy with some saucepans, I believe.
That's right, Hugo. Thanks for throwing to me there. I'm with Steve in the kitchen. A lot of excitement building here. Steve, you're busy with it. I see you've got some eggs. You've got whisk. You've got a whisk at hand. Remind us, first of all, tell us a little bit about, remind us about the sort of the significance of Pancake Day, both for you and for everyone here in the UK.
Well, it's Shrove Tuesday, day before Lent, so a big occasion for lots of people in the country. It's not just a religious thing, it's for everyone. Traditionally, you get rid of the last of your flour, which we have in here, eggs like this, a bit of milk as well, and the idea is to get rid of everything ahead of Lent. But frankly, it's also just an excuse to eat good food. Now, this recipe, some might say it's Delia Smith's. I would like to credit my mother, Jane Waddis. She's the one who taught me this. We made this every Pancake Day. And we're going to make it today and prove that, you know, we celebrate Shrove Tuesday better than everyone else.
Now, I know that one of the critical issues when rustling up pancakes is technique. A lot of it is about, you know, wrist action. Now, yeah. Some people have told me that, for some reason, I don't know, they think you're going to be very good at this. Are you pretty confident you're going to be able to deliver a quality product to us?
I think it's going to be fine. My big worry at the moment is, I should mention the greatest minds of Monocle at the moment in this kitchen, news editor Tom Edwards, foreigner to me, and our photo director, Poppy Shibamoto, is currently checking that the hob is working because I wasn't sure. But yes, when it comes to the flipping of the pancakes a little bit later, it's going to be pretty good.
So a lot of excitement out here in the kitchen, Hugo. I'll keep you posted. Steve's starting to some vigorous whisking is starting to take place,
and
we'll bring you the latest as I get it.
Thank you very much, Tom and Steve. Looking forward to seeing Steve tossing later. We'll get back to you in the show in probably about 20 minutes' time to find out how that's going. Coming up, we'll hear the lunchtime discussion topics from New York. Stay tuned.
From a breed of Italian sheep brought back from extinction to vintage recipes revitalising the dairy business in a remote part of Norway, Monocle Films brings you inspiring tales of mountain producers on a mission.
Mikhail's restaurants depend on locally sourced produce for its recipes, which have attracted a faithful following. It's proof, if ever proof were needed, that when restaurants work in collaboration with local food producers, it's possible to make a sustainable business out of organic farming and to create a distinct regional culinary identity.
Making it work in the mountains on Monocle.com.
Ambitious architects, best-in-show builders, concrete connoisseurs, density designers, energy evangelists, friendly foxes, guerrilla gardeners, high-minded historians, inspirational investors, jaded janitors, Kmart killjoys, low-rise lovers, mighty mayors, naughty nocturnalists, office block occupiers, plotting planners, quietness questers, rebels and reactionaries, spick-and-span street sweepers, transport theorists, urbane urbanists, visiting visionaries, wily wayfinders, exemplary exiles, you and yours, and zero-emission zealots. For a full A to Z of the people who make our metropolises rattle along like a well-designed subway and occasionally screech to halt like one too, listen to The Urbanist, the show about the cities we live in, presented by me, Andrew Tuck. It premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24. That's The Urbanist, the show for people who know that the countryside is for softies and that it doesn't matter if you can't find two words beginning with X.
Welcome back to Midori House, where the time in London is 18:16. That means it's 12:44. In New York, we're actually 12:16, I suppose, or 1:16 even. It's lunchtime, and we're going to check up on the burning topics being discussed by New Yorkers on their lunch break. So joining us now on the line from our New York bureau is our associate editor there, Barrett Austin. Barrett, thank you for joining us. And we heard from you earlier in the show that President Obama will deliver his State of the Union speech this evening. Tell us why this is so significant.
Well, it's important for a lot of reasons. This, of course, marks the second high-profile opportunity that President Obama has had to address the nation in less than a month. The first opportunity, of course, was his inaugural speech, which wasn't a policy speech per se, but in many ways it was his first opportunity to sort of lay out what his vision is for the next 4 years in office. The word from the White House is essentially that tonight's speech will follow off the main talking points from the speech that we heard earlier in the month. So you're likely to hear everything ranging from what President Obama has planned for making the economy a bit stronger, but we're also likely to hear real talking points on what his plan is for reducing gun violence, the issue of immigration, a whole host of other things that, you know, he'll really set the course for what the next 4 years means for him tonight.
I mean, gun control is obviously a very important emotional issue for Americans, but a bit of a political hot potato. How much do you think he will be focusing on something as controversial as this tonight?
I think it's something that can't really be missed. For President Obama and any political figure, he's well aware that the issue of gun control is somehow paradoxically one of the least popular issues that any politician can talk about. In America in particular, there's so many voters who are completely put off by the idea of talking about the issue of gun control because the idea of gun ownership in itself is seen so much as a fundamental right for so many Americans. But I think in the wake of the Sandy Hook shootings, it's something that he can't avoid. And I think for President Obama, especially coming from a city like Chicago, a city that has grappled with such strong issues of gun violence, it's something that really means something to the president. So I think we'll certainly hear about it tonight. What his plan entails, it's not really clear. We've heard a number of members of Congress come out with their own ideas. We've heard Vice President Joe Biden come out with his idea, the idea of an assault rifle ban or a whole range of things. But I think that it's certainly something that President Obama will talk about tonight and we'll hear much about in the coming days.
We'll be checking in with you, I'm sure, to digest everything that happens there this evening. There's also a new report out from the Aviation Safety Network, which tells us that commercial air travel is safer than ever in the US. Tell us a bit about this.
Apparently, the new report is suggesting that the flying on a commercial airline is today safer than any time in the history of the jet age. Today marks 4 years since the last American commercial plane crashed. So given that, I think that now more than ever, flying in a commercial plane is proving that it's proving to be very safe now.
Mm. What efforts has the aviation industry made to ensure that flights are safer for commercial passengers?
I think one of the simple issues is the idea of engineering. You have planes that are now engineered to really sort of deal with a lot of the issues that were causing problems for pilots in previous years. There are a number of navigation systems in place to prevent pilots from, you know, you're not having any of the, or nearly as many of the mid-air collisions that really stalked the industry for a number of years. There was also at one point an issue of a number of planes just sort of losing control and crashing into mountains. Again, thanks to the navigation systems, that's something that you're not seeing as much. But beyond that, the FAA has put much stricter regulations in place to make sure that pilots and co-pilots have all the training that they need. You look at co-pilots or first officers on airplanes today, and they're now required to spend, you know, a significant amount of time training, whereas before they were only required to do a much smaller number of hours before they could actually get behind the wheel of a plane.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's comforting.
Yeah, I think by all means.
But less comforting is the news that even though last year was the safest since 1945 in air travel, there were still 23 deadly crashes across the world, which to me seems like quite a lot. Not enough to make me stop getting on an aeroplane, but it's certainly more than I can remember counting from the headlines.
I think so. I think inevitably every time any of us gets on an airplane, we think, you know, sure, that sounds great, the facts and the figures, but 23 crashes in a year still seems like a lot. Hmm. But I was just reading a New York Times article, and there was a statistician from MIT, and the idea is basically that your chances of, let me see if I get this right, the chances of actually boarding a plane that ends up crashing, it's something like 1 in 45 million flights. So as this MIT statistician has put it, you could fly every day for an average of 123,000 years before you would likely be a victim of an airplane crash. So I would say that number in itself is a bit more reassuring.
Yes, that reassures me a lot more. You'd have to be very unlucky. Barrett, another big story out of New York this week is obviously the women's wear collections have descended. It's been Fashion Week. Have you been sashaying your way down the runway or maybe to a front row seat?
Many, many front row seats, of course. Last night, I had the chance to see the show by an Atlanta-born designer named Wes Gordon. Really great stuff. But I think something that we've been talking about here is it has, in many ways, become much of a circus. Mm. Getting into the show, there was a line outside in the rain, and there were a number of editors that I recognized and figures who typically wouldn't be waiting in line for anything. And in a case like this, they were being forced to wait for 10, 15 minutes outside just to get in and see the presentation.
Yeah,
just a little while ago, I had a chance to see J. Crew's presentation. Very, very impressive. This was at Lincoln Center, which is sort of ground zero, the epicenter for so many of the big shows, the big collections. Things there were a bit more orderly. But again, on the way into Lincoln Center, everyone's sort of jostling about with all of these fashion photographers and bloggers, really doing what they can to capture the spirit there. But it's all become so, so stressful.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? It's something that we will be talking about later on in the show with our own fashion director and head of marketing about how, you know, what goes on outside the show itself has almost become the show. And the bloggers and what the fashion editors wear and the queues and all the people still waiting to take pictures of their favourite celebrity dressed up to the nines in ridiculous towering heels sort of eclipses actually the news of fashion that is a business and an industry that sort of delivers an enormous amount of money each year, but sort of people are more keen on the superficial element of it now.
I think so. And if you look at the way the fashion weeks are done in certain other cities, it's something you're not noticing just in New York. You're noticing it in Milan. You're noticing it in Paris. And New York is just sort of a prime example of the way, you know, the excitement has really just sort of gone out of bounds. And you know, it's all great fun, but at the end of the day, it is very much it's a business. It's mm-hmm. not simply a matter of sort of having fun, having a party.
And do you get a sense that the city has a sigh of relief once the crowd moves on from New York to London?
I think so. In many ways, like I was just saying with Lincoln Center, I think so much of it is, as far as the presentations go, they're sort of relegated in certain areas. But in a week like this, going into any restaurant, any of the nicer restaurants in the city, all of the sort of fashion figures end up descending upon many of these places. So I think that it's hectic for a lot of people for a lot of reasons. But yeah, I would say that many New Yorkers really enjoy it, but the overwhelming majority of New Yorkers are sort of put off by the idea of having to deal with crowds like this.
Well, Monocle's Associate Editor Barrett Austin in New York, thank you very much for joining us. Have a great afternoon, and we will be picking up on that topic of the fashion circus later on in the show. It's 18:25 here in London. Before we have the news headlines at the bottom of the hour, time for some music. And this comes from Finland, no surprise, with our Finnish presenter, Markus Hippi, on the other side of the glass. This is Jenni Vartiainen with En halu kuolla tänä yönä. That was Jenni Vartiainen with En halu kuolla tänä yönä, which means I don't want to die tonight. We're going over to the kitchen in Midori House, where I hope Steve Bloomfield is not going to poison us all tonight with his pancakes.
There's no danger of that at all, Hugo. Steve is hard at work here. He's whisking out, I must say, it looks pretty good. Steve, are you happy with how your pancake mix is coming so far?
Perfect. I don't know about you, Tom, but we are ready to toss.
That's not a sentence I hear very often. We're lucky enough to be joined by not just Steve, who I'd consider a capable amateur, but by a polished professional, Sadaf Malik from Fika, a Swedish restaurant in Brick Lane, who's going to be rustling up some semla for us. Now, Sadaf, just tell me, I can see you've begun the preparations. Just describe to me what's happening with this mix that you've got here.
Well, we've got some cardamom buns, which we have removed the dough from, and we've mixed it into an almond paste. And we're going to put that almond paste back in the bun, top it over with some whipped cream, and put the lid back on and dust it with icing sugar.
But she's cheated. She's brought these in, like, yeah, they're ready made. Yeah, how do we know they're not from Tesco? I've made all this from scratch.
I can just say that, Hugo, in terms of the smells that are emanating so far, I'm leaning very slightly towards the semla, but it's going to be a close battle. It's going to be a close battle, so
I can hear desperation in Steve's voice. I'm definitely leaning towards the semla myself. Well, we'll be catching up with you later on in the show. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll discuss the future of Venice, the circus of Fashion Week, and the plight of parenting. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. North Korea has told the United Nations Disarmament Forum it'll never bow to UN resolutions on its nuclear program, despite worldwide condemnation of today's nuclear test. In other UN matters, the UN nuclear watchdog says it will work hard during talks in Tehran this week to try to bridge differences with Iran over a stalled investigation into its disputed nuclear activities. The European Union Commissioner Olli Rehn said today at an EU finance ministers' meeting in Brussels that the European Commission was not working on a debt restructuring plan for Cyprus. And Pope Benedict XVI is the first pope to resign in 700 years, saying he no longer has the mental and physical strength to carry on. He'll step down on the 28th of February. That's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald, where the time in London is 18:31. And you won't have failed to notice that it is Pancake Day or Shrove Tuesday, whatever you'd like to call it. And that our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, is in the Midori House kitchen preparing pancakes with which to celebrate the day. We also have a Nordic challenger who we met very briefly, and Tom Edwards is back with her in the kitchen. I'm intrigued to hear a little bit more about the story behind semla. Tom, maybe you can enlighten us.
That's right, Hugo. Yeah, I'm here with Sadaf Malik in our kitchen here in Midori House. I'm knocking over pots and pans as I go. Sadaf, so you were describing to us the stuffing for these semla. Just tell us a little bit about the tradition. How is this consumed on Shrove Tuesday? Does everyone get together with their families? What's the kind of the history of it?
I can tell you how important semla are today in Sweden. People are actually looking for the best semla in the whole city, in the whole of Sweden, and the newspaper will report back about it. How you eat it is very much how, like an Oreo or like a Jaffa cake. It's some people like to turn it upside down first, some people like to eat the stuffing first, others like to eat the lid first. So it's very much a debate today in Sweden about how you eat it and where you buy yours.
And so tell me, what's the Sadaf Malik secret then? How do you ensure that yours are so particularly good? And very good they do look, I must say.
It's a good balance amongst each ingredient and cardamom. We love the cardamom at Fika, so the cardamom presence is very important.
Okay, and then just so we're kind of stuffing the ingredients in now. And then in terms of when they're actually served, what happens then when they're sort of plated up for people?
Most people will not use the utensils and just bite right into it and have the cream all over their face.
That's very much my strategy, unfortunately. Now, just very briefly, I'll leave Sanaf there. She's very busy preparing notes. Steve, you've got pancakes actually frying away now. How confident are you that you're going to deliver this time? It looks pretty good.
Well, look, the first pancake is always the trickiest because, you know, the pan's just got a bit hot. You've just put your butter in and then you've got your ladle out and put your first bit of pancake mixture in. So this one will be a bit tricky, but should we do the first flip? And
see very quick. Let's see how you get on. Stand by, everyone.
Hang on. It's a little bit, but we'll see. I'm confident. The first one's always difficult, you know? Anyway, hang on. Here it goes. Oh.
Not an unequivocal success, Hugo, but you...
It's fine.
And the proof of these particular puddings will be very much in the eating. You'll be sampling them later and you can give your own verdict.
We will indeed. We'll have both semla and the fruits of Steve's labour, his pancakes, which sounded a little bit sorry from that flipping, Steve. Better luck next time. That was Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards, speaking to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, busy with the pancake pan and with Sadaf Malik, owner of Fika Cafe, with her semlas. You're listening to Monocle 24, Midori House. Welcome back to Midori House here, live from London, where the time is 18:34. Now, parenting is a tricky business. Anyone who claims it's a walk in the park is lying, definitely to you and most likely to themselves too. While handbooks can dish out advice on the practicalities of the likes of breastfeeding or teething tricks for the early stages, there's definitely no guide and certainly no right or wrong when it comes to raising a child. Acclaimed New York author Andrew Solomon has written a tome that might just be the closest thing to a parenting handbook, though. Far from a didactic rulebook, it's the product of 10 years' work, the sum of interviews with around 300 families from all walks of life. All that connects them is that they are parents raising children, telling their stories. The book is called Far From the Tree, A Dozen Kinds of Love, and Andrew Solomon joins me in the studio now. Andrew, thank you very much for coming in, and firstly, congratulations. It's fascinating.
Thank you.
I can't say that I've... read it in its entirety, but I definitely will read it because I've been gripped from the bits that I
order.
Have read. I know. I have to say that I should have had more than 2 days to have worked my way through it. Where did the idea come from in the first place? I mean, 10 years is a labour of love. It's almost a child in itself.
Well, almost 20 years ago, I had an assignment from the New York Times Magazine to write about the deaf. And when I went off to write about deaf culture, I discovered that most deaf children are born to hearing parents, that those parents mostly want to get them to function in the hearing world, and that those deaf people mostly acquire an identity as deaf people in adolescence as they begin to meet a peer group. And I thought there was such a parallel between that experience and my experience as a gay person, that gayness is also an identity that's alien to one's parents, and usually your feeling of it as an identity comes in adolescence or thereafter. And then a friend of mine had a daughter who was a dwarf, and it turns out most dwarfs are born to parents of average height. And she began saying, do I tell her she's just like everyone else, only a bit short? Do I get involved with little people organizations and try to give her? And as she talked about her bewilderment, I thought, oh my God, there it is again. And I suddenly thought, if it's true for these three categories, it must be true for a lot of others.
And I mean, we mentioned there in the introduction that you spoke to over 300 families. I mean, you saw this theme presumably again and again and again, but what seems to be the most interesting thing is the fact that actually there are so many stories of optimism. And one of the best things that I've taken from what I've read so far is the fact that it's a better time now to be growing up as a child of, you know, difference to parents, and that parents are actually much more accepting of the way that they bring children up than they ever have been before. Do you feel, was that the case as you were going through the book a lot?
That was definitely the case. We're having this funny mix of social progress, which makes these conditions more acceptable, and medical progress, which makes them easier to obliterate. So we have the two things going on at once. But I think there is more acceptance from families, more acceptance from society. And in the era of the internet, it's much easier if you have a child who's extraordinary, or if you are a person who has an unusual identity, you can find a whole group of people who have that in common with you in a way you never used to be able to. So there are new communities arising around each of the conditions I've written about.
Tell us a bit about how the book is structured. and how you sort of went about dividing it up, because, I mean, it's a big topic.
So it's got a first chapter, which is about my experience as the gay child of straight parents. And then it has chapters on deafness, dwarfism, Down syndrome, autism, schizophrenia, severe disability, musical prodigies and their families who are also quite overwhelmed, families bring up children conceived in rape, families of people who commit crimes, families of people who are transgender, and then a conclusion about my experience of becoming a parent myself and what that was like. And the idea is to look at all of these situations in which you have children who have a central defining characteristic which is alien to their families, and to look at how an identity politics has emerged, and to say, okay, each of these things has been considered an illness. Each of these things can also be considered an identity. And as someone who grew up when being gay was obviously considered an illness, and who now lives an adult life in which it's obviously an identity, I thought, how did we manage to make that shift? How did I manage to make that shift? Who else might be able to make the same shift?
Do you think people reading this will, you know, it will touch everybody in some way? It can't fail but to. Will it make them a better parent?
I'd like to think it will make them a better parent. I was very thrilled that when it was reviewed in the New York Times, that was one of the things they said was, it's impossible to read this book and not become a better parent as a result. I just think parenthood involves not only loving your child, but also seeing your child. And seeing your child entails accepting your child. And in the same way that we sort of test flame-retardant pajamas by throwing them in an inferno to make sure they won't catch fire when we reach across the stove, so every family has to deal with some degree of difference. And I hope this perhaps gives them some signposts for how to get through it.
Thank you very much indeed, Andrew Solomon, author of Far From the Tree, published by Chatto and Windus. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this to hear how and if we even can save Venice.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London, W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wing Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The latest culinary trends, restaurants with the best food, the coziest cafes and the makers behind them. The menu tells you all you need to know about the world of cuisine and drinks and the people who are doing things differently.
The end is very important, just as in a sad ending, you may feel sort of sad in a play. No, there's no such thing as a sad ending for a meal, but there is the idea of a resounding ending, like the coda of a last movement of a symphony.
From organic cuisine in Sao Paulo to the latest coffee trends in Helsinki, from the most adventurous speakeasy in New York to the best butchers in Sydney, tune in on Fridays at 1900 hours London time or download the shows from Monocle's website.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
Welcome back to Midori House, live from London, where the time is 18:41. Now, you don't need to have visited Venice to know that the northern Italian city is in a fairly perilous state. Anyone who has visited it will be more aware than ever. Rising sea levels, crumbling buildings above and below water, and vast cruise ships are conspiring to turn the fairy tale city into a sinking urban masterpiece. Of course, no one wants to sit back and watch this happen, but equally, no one really has a clue what to do. Anna Summers Cox, founding editor of the Art newspaper and former chairman of the Venice in Peril Fund, will tonight give the annual World Monument Fund lecture in New York on Venice and what can be done to save it. She joins us now from our New York bureau. Anna, thank you very much for joining us. This is obviously a subject very close to your heart. It's not as bad as many people believe it is, and there are actually many, many efforts to do some quite serious changes that will save Venice. Maybe you could start by telling us about them.
The main thing that's happening is that they're building these great big barriers in the three openings between the Adriatic Sea and the lagoon. And these, when they're completed in 2014, will be great for stopping high water events like the one last night where the chairs in Mark Square were actually sort of underwater. What, however, they can't do is anything about the constantly rising water level.
Mm. And, I mean, is this the MOSES project, that these big barriers?
That's MOSES,
yeah. MOSES, exactly. So there seems to be some dispute as to how effectively they will actually work, but... I mean, people in Venice who I spoke to during the architecture biennale last summer are pinning all their hopes on this as being a very big turning point in the fortunes of keeping Venice above water. How much do we really know about how they will work once they're fully in place in 2014?
Well, what we have to assume is the engineering will work. I mean, there's no reason to imagine that they won't. Italians are very good engineers. But as I say, they can't do anything about the fact that the water is too high and will be much, much higher. I mean, the IPCC, which is called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the big kind of world organization that is making the predictions, says that by the end of the century, the water will be 60 centimeters higher. And the water is already above the level that those very old houses were built for. It's now against the brickwork, it's crumbling the brickwork. So you're not only going to have kind of the city rotting from the feet up, but I think perhaps the most important thing is that there is nobody in charge. This sounds incredible, but the mayor doesn't have full responsibility. None of the ministries does either. It's a great mass of organizations, some of which are in open conflict with each other. Nobody has the situation under control.
I mean, that was going to be one of my next questions, actually, was who are the key players and what are they doing and are they working together? But as so often the case in so much of Italian life, it's a bit chaotic and sort of uncoordinated and ruined by bureaucratic nightmares. How bad does it need to get before someone actually just stands up and says, OK, enough's enough, this is ridiculous?
I think the main trouble is that everything proceeds by stealth. I mean, the number of cruise ships has multiplied massively. Nobody planned them, but they've happened. Now they're so important economically, and the Venice Port Authority is very politically powerful. They don't want to see them move out. The rising water level is slow, but it is absolutely ineluctable. The number of tourists is growing the whole time, but who is actually going to say, right, we're going to limit the numbers? The town council has just come out with a management plan which doesn't mention the cruise ships once. Mm. Doesn't say that tourist numbers are going to have to be limited, and doesn't mention the rising water level as being the great threat to the city. Can you imagine that?
It's crazy. I mean, the other thing I really wanted to bring up with you is this hulking cruise ships that come through the lagoon in front of St. Mark's Square, and I mean, it looks so wrong apart from anything, and you have everybody standing on the decks taking pictures of St. Mark's Square and everyone outside St. Mark's Square taking pictures of the cruise ships, which just dwarf this incredible, beautiful city. They presumably have quite a lot to answer for in terms of damage too. I'm afraid it seems like we have lost the connection to our New York bureau, but that was Anna Summers Cox, who is tonight delivering the Venice in Peril lecture at the World Monument Fund, or the World Monument Fund lecture on Venice in Peril. We will be back with a discussion about whether the fashion industry is turning into more of a circus than a circuit after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monaco 24.
Ot London, du er Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette er Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Og London.
London, Europa.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monaco 24.
Welcome back. It's 1846 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. And now with the women's collections underway from New York to London, soon to be Milan and then Paris, there's a growing clamour for sense to be restored among the true fashion fans. Susie Menkes penned a brilliant editorial in the New York Times, likening the growing frenzy of bloggers and outrageous outfits of editors to a circus. She called for a return to the days of mystery, pared down elegance, decorum, and a return to focusing on the fashion that takes place indoors, not on the steps outside the venue. There's no doubt the industry has changed with the rise of blogging, smartphones, fast fashion and saturated celebrity culture. Is it even possible to strip any of this away? joining us to give their expert advice on the situation is our very own fashion director, Takaharu Sato, and Monocle's events and marketing manager, who's no stranger to a fashion blog or to herself, Emily Smith. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Take, you cover the shows, men's, yes, women's, in bits and bobs. You must have seen this change as well. I mean, it seems that it has reached sort of epic proportions now.
Yes. I started going to the shows in Paris and Milan, etc., since we launched the magazine. So that means it was about
six years ago.
Yeah, 6 years ago. And yes, you know, like since I read Susie Menkes's article, and I completely agree with her, although, you know, she has been to the shows since many years, and she must have recognized lots of different changes, yeah, more than I do recently. I recognize, like, obviously, like,
just from a practical point of view, getting into a show now, it's not the sort of, no longer you have the golden ticket and you can slip in and you take your seat. You know, it's a bit like walking down a red carpet outside a venue.
Something like that, yeah.
People get dressed up to be photographed.
Yes,
and Emily, I'll bring you in here now because, I mean, yeah, we were talking earlier today and you were saying that you have friends who feel that they've failed almost fashion editors if they haven't been sort of papped by bloggers on their way into the show.
Yeah, I have quite a few editor friends, and it's, you know, it's not so, the importance is funny, this is like, you know, double edged. It's what you're wearing and what you look like is part of the role of what you're writing about.
Yeah.
But I think this story is amazing. It's like the perfect jewel. It's like Susie Menkes, she's been writing since 1988 for the IHT. She's this legend. She has an OBE. She went to Cambridge. She's mm-hmm. written four books. And she must be looking at these little bloggers who pick up a shot from Instagram and judge a whole collection. Mm. You know, when she's all about, she wants to see how the fabric moves. She wants to see it in 3D. She wants to feel it. Mm. And I think that the article is fascinating because it's finally, it's
exactly,
like she's
we've
thrown
all been
down
waiting
the gauntlet.
Yeah. I know. And I mean, it's something that we've all spoken about sort of in the office, on the radio numerous times. It's something that everybody says behind their hands is how ridiculous. And you see people tweeting every single picture of the show without actually really looking at what's going on in real time. And like you say, she's thrown down the gauntlet.
She really
but
has.
But what, I mean, how, and she and it's ends not, and the piece by saying, you know, can really any of this change?
And she does give respect. Like, you know, there are, it's the world's change. And it's, and it's not, I mean, you know, I feel like part of this argument is what we talk about at Monocle about reporting. You know, you want to be on the scene. You don't want to be on your computer, like, rehashing something. And it happens with design as well. Like,
exactly.
Objectified, right? That movie was basically about.
And, I mean, any of the trade fairs, so many of the editors now say, it costs so much to go to the trade fair. I can see everything that's been launched on a blog instead.
Yeah.
It's like, no, this is furniture. This is people. Mm. You don't get to talk to the people. You don't get to sit on the chair.
Exactly.
You know, you are actually consuming an industry in a very, very different way. And you're not really able to form an opinion based on one little snapshot that's been taken on someone's camera phone, even if it has been uploaded in real time.
And I don't know. I mean, what do you think, Take? Like, I'm such a big consumer of Fashion Week. I love it. I get excited about it. I used to work for it. I'll, you know, if I want to see an opinion that counts, I look to Susie. I look to Kathy from the New York Times. Yeah. I look to The Cut, you know, in New York Magazine. But if I do want to see what the bloggers, what the street style is, it is something I do look at now too. Like, I'll look at Tommy Tom,
yes,
or I'll look
at,
you know, I'll have a look to see because it's fun. Mm. And I think that both can exist. I think, you know.
Both can exist, but maybe the line between the two needs to be divided.
Yeah.
They are actually the trendsetters, tastemakers.
Yeah.
And they, although they are, most of them are quite young, you know, late teens or like early 20s, but they get seated at the front rows of all the fashion shows. They are treated like very important part of the shows. And then they decide, you know, what's good and what are not good. And then it's also, I think, you know, for the young people like who consume fashion, like trend, following the trends, like it's also fun to check out what's happening like live in a way. So it's definitely like all the format is changing and more digitalizing and fast.
You know,
straight away you need to see something what's happening.
Do you think there will be a return to the sort of mystery that Fashion Week used to be about, where, you know, there will be an incredibly secret venue and people will have cars or motorbikes or something to take them to something on the other side of town where it will be away from all of these bloggers with the camera phones and sort of the crowds that turn up just to see the crowds going into the shows.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually the focus is back on the collection that's being launched rather than sort of the entire industry that goes on around it.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, that's my focus as well. I'd like to see what
no, the, you're just
our
standing
favorite
there
brands
Pat
are showing.
In your kimono. Look at yeah.
me. Well, I have to say I've done it in the past. But recently, yeah, I've kind of stopped doing it because I wanted to focus more on the clothes.
Well, our fashion director Takaharu Sato and marketing manager and events manager Emily Smith, thank you very much for sharing your wisdom.
Pleasure.
We're going to have a fashion tune now. This is Lady Gaga with Fashion of His Love.
I never was the kind of girl that's naturally sure when it comes to love. Oh no, I was insecure.
That was The Fashion of His Love by Lady Gaga. It's 18:55 and it's the moment you've all been waiting for here on Midori House. We have the fruits of foreign editor Steve Bloomfield's labour in on a plate here. It's a rather soggy looking pancake. Much more excitingly, we have Saraf Malik and her Nordic Shrove Buns Semlas. Saraf, you've joined us. Thank you very much indeed. I think this is going to be the saviour of, or definitely the victor in terms of the bun war that we've been having throughout the show. Tell us a little bit about how you made this beautiful semla.
Semla is made out of, you use butter, milk, yeast, sugar, flour, and the most important ingredient, cardamom.
Mm.
You make it like bread. And then once the buns are made, they you need to let them rise for about an hour.
Yeah.
And once they're made, you do what we talked about in the kitchen.
Yeah.
You
scoop out the
scoop
inside.
Scoop out the inside, mix it in with the almond paste.
Stuff it in almond paste
yes.
and cream. Gosh, it's delicious. There's a lot of cream in there.
There's a lot of cream in there.
I was in Sweden last week and they were served to me. Well, actually, there were pictures of them everywhere. They must be very, very popular.
Very big thing at the moment.
Yeah, and in all the 7-Elevens and things, you get them in different shapes mm-hmm. and sizes. I was given them at a meeting and it is just about the most impossible thing to eat at a conference room table with sort of six people trying to talk business.
It's about the size of a tennis ball, so yeah. You can't quite put that in your mouth very easily.
Everywhere. It was also served to me at breakfast, which was a bit of a shock for one who doesn't really like breakfast. Or cream at the best of times. Yours is very good. Steve, you've hopped in.
Hello, I have.
Just tell us about your pancakes.
Yeah, so pancakes. Mm. I mean, what's not to say about pancakes? They're amazing, they're brilliant, they're lovely. They're quite straightforward to do.
Oh,
don't spill it.
No, it's fine. It's just a nice grease stain on my trousers now.
So what, there, I'll hold it underneath you and you eat it.
Thank you, Steve. This is Granny Bloomfield's recipe, is it?
No, it's my mum's. To be honest, I think it's probably Delia Smith's, but my mum nicked it from Delia.
Surprisingly good. You're not just good with foreign affairs. I take it back.
It's all right, isn't it? Mm. It's like, so this is the simple thing of doing, the simple way of eating pancakes. It's with caster sugar and lemon juice. And that's the classic. Mm. But the great thing about this is that it is a great meal and you can have it with all sorts of other things. And so, when I was growing up, we'd have it with, ratatouille, and then you'd have one with maybe some sort of cream cheese and smoked salmon. And then for dessert, you have this one with the caster sugar and the lemon.
Lovely. Well, Saraf Malik, your semla has got my vote, and
what?
I'm glad to see there's only a minute left of the show so that I can really tuck into it properly. Saraf Malik from Nordic Cafe Fika in London, Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield, thank you very much for joining us.
And that's it's actually all right, isn't it?
It's delicious.
I know, just eating it now.
No, yeah, I'm talking about the semla.
Oh, yeah, go on then.
Okay, that's all we have time for today on Midori House. Thank you very much to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Next up is a very Swedish special edition of Section D coming to you from the Stockholm Furniture Fair. And in 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and Phil Hahn will be back for the Monocle Daily. Andrew Muller will also be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But in the meantime, from me, Hugo MacDonald, and a very big semla bun, have a great Shrove Tuesday. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.